introduce our speaker for tonight, who is Jeff W. from Feet First.
What's happening, guys? My name is Jeff Malcock. I'm kind of the pinch hitter tonight. Barefoot Bill, who was supposed to be our speaker tonight, fell ill and couldn't make it up. We found out about 4 o'clock tonight. He was going to try to make it. He was kind of hoping. That's why he kind of waited, because he thought maybe he would be able to come up, but he just was too sick. And so we rescheduled him June 3rd, I believe, first week in June. So he'll be back with us then, or with us at that point. So we tried to find a couple other people, some other home group members to get up here, and they were either unavailable or had spoken here. So she asked him, Sarah asked me to do it, so I said yes. So here I am, speaking of my home group. Yeah. My second week here in a tie, believe it or not. Hope that's not a trend. So my name is Jeff, and I told you I'm Al Kalk, and this is my home group. I love this group. I've been coming here since my sobriety date, August 29th, 2007. That following Monday, which was the first Monday in June, which is very, I guess that was like, is that Labor Day? I don't know, something like that. Right before Labor Day, maybe? I don't know, but it was first... No, Labor Day. It was August 29th, 2007. Oh, did I? I'm sorry. August 29th, 2007. Thank you. And so it would have been whatever that was, that first week in September. And I met this guy. I was 2 days sober, and I met this guy, and he had this sense of serenity and peace about him that I had never had, ever. And maybe when I was passed out, I probably had it, but other than that, I'd never really experienced anything like that. And he was walking around, and some guy told me to go talk to him, and I didn't really want to. And he kind of annoyed me into going to talk to him. He just wouldn't let up. So I finally went in the kitchen, and I talked to this guy, and I didn't know he was going to be my sponsor. I didn't know he was going to become my sponsor, and he did. And I remember him just giving me some little test of willingness, which was like, go home and read the book and call me. And so I did that. And I met him the next day on Sunday, and we went up to Grandview, and I met a couple fellow home group members there for the first time ever in my life, and some of those people I've become very, very close to. If you would have asked me that night, actually the one guy was chairing the meeting at Grandview, and I couldn't say that I really liked him or disliked him, but there wasn't anything that I was really like, wow, that guy's really cool, I want to get to know him, but now he's become one of my best friends, which is... Like, if you would have asked me that night and said that, I would have been like, that guy? No way. No way. But he's awesome. I love him. He's actually in Arizona. So let's just pray for a safe flight home from him. I think he's coming home soon. So anyway, he told me to come here. That was a Sunday night. We got together at Grandview. And the next night he said, I want you to be at this meeting up here in Quakertown on Monday nights at 8 o'clock. And I was like, dude, Quakertown? What the fuck? Go to all the way to Quakertown, man. I live in New Jersey. I'm like, isn't there meetings like you can just? He lives in Regalsville, which is very close to me. Isn't there someplace closer? He's like, no, that's my home group. I want it to be your home group. Come up here and be there at 8 o'clock or 7:30, whenever he told me to be here. That meeting's at 8. I remember pulling in, and it was a beautiful, warm night. And I was like, you know, I had some hope at that point because we started talking about, you know, hopeful things with me, like sharing some hope that he had. I still wasn't really, I had like 4 or 5 days sober. I wasn't really all that hopeful at that point. You know, I wasn't like happy, joyous, free, that's for sure. And I remember pulling in here, and there was a bunch of people all hanging out down there with like lawn chairs and blankets and hanging out on picnic tables, smoking, and kids were playing on the swing set. And I pulled in and I was like, dude, is this like a family reunion? What's going on with this place? Is this like some kind of picnic going on? Like, what is going on here? And I got out and I walked up, and there was all kinds of people that were just like so happy to see me. I had never experienced anything like that. You know, I've been to quite a few AA meetings because this is my first time in AA, but I had never experienced anything like that. And it was just awesome. I was just like, holy crap, this is where if I'm gonna have a home group, this is gonna be it. And it has been. And I love this group. I love being part of this group. So like I said, it's not my first sobriety date. August 29th, 2007. Not June, August. And so it's not my first sobriety date, although it's my current sobriety date. And I have a sponsor who's taken me through the work, and I've had the absolute honor and privilege to take other people through the work. which is absolutely amazing, amazing experience. But again, that's not my first time in AA. I'll kind of just qualify a little bit and then kind of get right into when I actually first came to AA. I grew up in a very loving family. No alcoholism really in my family that was to speak of, I guess maybe prior generations, but nothing in my immediate family. Loving mom and dad, married, they have a little business, they work together with my grandparents, my grandmother, my grandfather, my aunt, my mom, my dad, my brothers. As I grew up, I worked there, I still work there today, and it was a total family business. And they went to church every Sunday, and they were very absolute, supportive, loving, caring family, parents. There was one problem. I was always really pretty much concerned with myself and my fear and my problems and my uncomfortability that I really made it pretty hard for me to actually experience that love that I knew they had. And, you know, they provided absolutely, you know, without a doubt, they provided for me perfectly. It's just I couldn't experience it. You know, Scott said it last week when he was up here. He said, you know, people love me, and I couldn't experience that love, and that's exactly how it was for me. I was something was keeping me from experiencing that, and I couldn't have told you what it was. I couldn't even have told you that I couldn't experience that love. All that I knew is that there was this thing, love, and I really didn't know much about it, and I just knew, to be honest with you, I if you would have asked me, I would have just been like, yeah, I'm just uncomfortable. You know, and I hear a lot of people that talk about, oh, well, nothing was ever enough. I needed more, I needed more, I needed more. And that's not really my experience, maybe with alcohol, but with life, it was always just not right. Like, it wasn't like I needed more of anything. It just, I needed something else. Like, whatever it was just not right. You know what I mean? It wasn't like, I couldn't, like, conceptualize and say, well, if I just had more of this, it'd be great. I was just like, no, this isn't right. Whether it's the family I was in, the friends I had, how much money I had or didn't have, how tall I was, how short I was, just nothing was right, you know. And I just always had this sense of something was just missing, and I couldn't tell you what it was. I just knew it was missing. And as a result of that, I was afraid. You know, I can tell you this, that I always felt as if I wanted to be a part of, like, experience this thing with you guys, this thing called life, and I just seemed like I couldn't, and but I wanted to, really, really bad, and I just couldn't. You know, it was very difficult for me. I was a very scared little kid. I had some stuff happen to me when I was a little kid. I was going to this church my parents went to, and they made me go up till the point when I was old enough that they couldn't. And as soon as they, you know, I was old enough that I could make that choice, I didn't go because I wasn't really all that happy with what I heard at that church. People were nice, but just the message they had just wasn't all that attractive to me. And I had some other stuff that happened when I was a kid that I would absolutely, when I got here, told you that that's why I'm alcoholic. And but I realized today that it hasn't, through, you know, doing an inventory with a sponsor and working with other people, I realized today that what happened to me as a kid has nothing to do with why I'm alcoholic. I was molested when I was around the age of 7, and I was going to this church, and this church was saying stuff like, you know, God gives us everything, and you know, but everything is from God, and God provides us everything. And I had this thing that I wasn't all that happy about, and I was like, well, what the hell? Why would God do this to a kid? Why would God give this thing to them? And I was like, yeah, you can keep your God. I don't want anything to do with that God. And that's kind of how it was for really till I got here this time. You know, I'd been here a few times, and I wasn't searching for God those times either, and I certainly wasn't searching for God when I came here this time. It just so happened that I was desperate enough to put aside some of my old ideas and maybe have a new concept of what God was. And as a result of that and doing some other work, you know, I come to have a relationship with a God of my understanding today that's absolutely awesome, makes the way I see the world just incredibly peaceful to me, regardless of what's going on out there. But at this time, I didn't have that, and church didn't give that to me for whatever reason. I'm sure it was there. I'm sure it was available. I just wasn't seeing it or hearing it. Probably because I was totally consumed with me. And it's hard for me to hear or see anything out there if I'm totally consumed with myself. So I probably missed out on a lot of things, a lot of messages, a lot of messengers along the way. But, you know, the teacher appeared when I needed him. So I come out of this church and I didn't want to go anymore, and I had this family that I really didn't feel a part of, although I would have told you that I loved them, but it probably would have just been a word. I knew that they loved me, but then again, it seemed like just a word to me. I didn't really know what the experiential part of that was. And I was just consumed in fear, man. My life was just all about just being afraid of just not getting what I wanted or losing what I had or particularly what people thought of me. That was just pervaded my life. You know, those three areas were it for me. That's what I was always thinking about. Not getting what I wanted, losing what I had, or just, what are you thinking of me? What are you thinking of me? I read this thing this actually before I came here, this little devotional thing that my parents have laying around their house. And it was talking about how, you know, in our society, we really, these stores have their employees dress, these clothing stores have their employees dress in clothes that they sell or have in the window. With the thought being that if when you walk in there, you see these people all dressed nice and neatly in their nice clothes that are sold there, that you're going to buy their clothes. And this guy who wrote this kind of paralleled that to our, you know, to our walk in life. And he said, you know, God's not really concerned with how we look. He's more concerned with the content of our heart and our content of our character. And for a long time, I was always concerned with how I looked. You know, content of my heart was like, yeah, whatever. I'll never let you know that. And if I let you know that and you find it out, I'm just going to go find somebody else because you're not going to want to be friends with me anyway. So I was all about the way I looked and convincing you that I was absolutely what you wanted me to be. And I spent a lot of time and energy doing that, man. A lot. I mean, that was most of my life was spent trying to figure out what I thought you wanted me to be and then trying to be that. And all that was based out of fear because I was afraid you weren't going to want to be my friend anyway. And I wanted you to accept me, right? So I'm like, I want you to accept me. I don't feel accepted. So I had this fear that you're not going to accept me. So I conjure up, based out of fear, I take this action, which is tell you a bunch of lies. And then unfortunately, my next thought after I lie to you is, holy crap, what's going to happen when they find out that I'm lying? You know? So it's like fear would produce this reaction in me, which I would take an action based in that fear, and then that would just create more fear. Now, if you just project that out, you know, it's pretty obvious to see that just fear was just, my life is just riddled with it, man. It's just riddled with it. And, you know, I don't know about you guys, but when I'm living in fear, my life's not comfortable. Not comfortable. I don't like the way this world looks. I don't like the way I feel. I don't like the way you sound. I don't like the way you say. You know, I don't like the way I say. I don't like, you know, it's, I like nothing about it. About this world when I'm living in fear, and that was all my life was about, was fear. I when I was about around 13 years old, I had a friend over my house, and up to this point, I had been living in just 13 years of terror, although I didn't want you to think I was living in terror, so I was lying to you constantly, hoping that you weren't going to find out that I was really just this scared kid. And when I was 13, I had this friend over, and he stayed over, and one night we snuck out that night, and I stole a bottle of wine out of my parents' liquor cabinet. They didn't drink it because, again, they weren't alcoholics. I don't think I've ever seen my mom drink maybe a glass of wine, my dad a glass of wine at Christmas or something, Thanksgiving, but other than that, they didn't drink. And so, consequently, luckily for me, they had a big old cabinet full of booze, and I took it upon myself to relieve them of some of the responsibility of drinking that booze, and I stole a bottle of wine, and it was horrible, and me and my buddy snuck out, and my mind, prior to doing this, is like, just going, like the hamster wheel, or like the wall of TVs, you know, I hear all these different explanations, but my mind's just going, like it normally is, you know, like, what are people thinking of me? It's all based in fear, you know, what are people thinking, what are they going to say, when they say this, I'm going to have to say that, well, if they go there, and then I'm going to tell them this, and if they go there, well, I'm going to try to go over there, but if I can't go there, I'm going to have to tell them this, and then when they say this, they're going to ask me this, and I'm like, going, totally projecting out into, you know, 5 months from now, really, and, you know, caught up in what happened 2 weeks ago, because I'm using that against you because, you know, it just was crazy, never in the moment. And I steal this bottle of wine, and we're sneaking out. I'm like, holy crap, what's going to happen? He gets there, we're going to drink this. What if we get drunk? What are we going to do? You know, I'm like, going. And I'm like, I get out there. I'm like, what do I have? My parents find out. What are they going to ask me? I'm going to have to make up some excuse. Well, I'll just tell them that they did it. I'm telling them that the kid took it. You know what I mean? I'm like, going on and on and on and on. And we sneak up this little, like, I'm like 2 houses up from a church that we used to go to, and there's this little graveyard, and there was this big, big bush that was right in the middle, and as kids we used to climb in the middle of that bush and we'd hang out. It was like our little fort. So I got this kid, and we went up there, and we had this bottle of this really horrible, tasted like cough syrup wine from New York, some crappy wine, and we started drinking it. And I can't say that I puked, I threw up. I can't say that he took one swig off the wine and I drank the rest of the bottle. None of those things happened. I don't know if you say I wasn't instant alcoholic, whatever. But I remember this, that after about two or three swigs off that wine, I remember feeling it go down and feeling that warmth. But I remember this more than anything. My mind, which was at this point just going, just slowly started to and quiet down. And I wasn't really concerned with what that kid thought anymore. I wasn't really concerned with what he said. I didn't really care if my parents caught me. It was like I was just at perfect comfort and ease being right where I was at that moment. And for 13 years, I never felt that, never. And I just was like, oh, man, this is good. I can just sit right here and I can just be okay right here, right now. And it was like the first time I ever experienced just being present, And for, a kid who spent 13 years never being able to feel that, it was a pretty magical thing. It's a magical thing. And I had pretty made a decision at that point that, I'm going to do this again as soon as possible, preferably. My parents were pretty strict. I didn't really get out. I live in the middle of nowhere. So the only times I could get out was when I, snuck out or that type of stuff. So it wasn't like I was like, okay, I started hitting the bottle at 14 and was, on the streets. I just basically check that in my memory of, okay, you remember how that felt? Well, when you get a chance to do that again, you're gonna. And I did, whenever I got a chance to. It wasn't all the time, but I did. I know this, that by the time I was 14, 15 in school, in high school, I was absolutely adamant about becoming friends with all the seniors because they drove and they could get me where I wanted to go. And most of the time they were at the parties, and that's what I did. That's what I did. By the time I was 18, I was one of those guys. And I had this really cheesy little mustache when I was 18 that I was really proud of. This little caterpillar looking mustache. And I was all proud because I had missed the date for my deadline to be in school by the age of 6, so I had to wait an extra year to go into kindergarten. So I was a little older than most of the kids in my grade. I was actually 18 by the November of my senior year, so I could sign myself out of school and all those types of things. And I had a car and I could get served. I could get served booze. And that's nothing really remarkable about that. There's a lot of kids that get served underage. But the thing that was remarkable about me for me was that I had this thing called selfishness and self-centeredness, and I was all about getting what I wanted. And I would have told you, I would have probably thought at the time, I would have been like, when I came home on a Friday night, before cell phones and even the time before answering machines, when you actually had to be home to answer your phone, I would sit home and I'd wait, or I'd be calling. And if they weren't home, I'd be calling. And if there was a busy signal, which we used to get, I would call and call and call until it would go through and it would ring. Sometimes it would just ring, but either way, I was trying to get a hold of these people or waiting for them to get a hold of me. And when I did, and they were like, okay, what are you doing tonight? You going to the liquor store? I'm like, yes, absolutely. What do you want? Where are we going? And I'd get a bunch of booze, and I would have told you, yeah, I was doing it because I have all these friends, and, I just wanted to be popular, and I wanted, you to accept me and all this stuff. But the real reason, when I look back at it now, is that I knew I had something you wanted. And I knew this, that if I had what you wanted, there's a better chance I'm going to get what I want from you. And that's probably what it was all about. It's all about me using what I have in order to get what I want from you. Now, don't get me wrong. I loved drinking. I loved it. It did that. It allowed me to actually hang out with you and not be afraid to talk and look you in the eye and do things that I wanted to do or feel part of. It just allowed me to do that. But it was all about, getting what I wanted, really. And I also knew this, that if I got you drunk enough, that probably you'd lower your inhibitions enough that I could probably even better chance to get what I wanted or get you to do things that I wanted you to do. And that's really what it's all about. That's really what it's all about. So I went a long time, man. I didn't suffer a lot of consequences drinking, really. I didn't. Drinking did the magic for me. It was something I loved to do. Early on, I found myself drinking excessively. I did, have some run-ins with the law, but not often. I had a DUI by the time I was 20. But I learned this, just don't get caught. Just don't get caught. Drive on the back roads, all those things we do, Just, I used to have this van. I played drums in a band, and I had this van that had all these blacked out windows, and I loved it because I could go to a bar and I could get hammered, and I had this roll out mattress in the van, and I could come out in my van and I could just sleep wherever I was, you know. And it was very convenient, you know. Saved me probably a lot of nights from not only getting a DUI, but probably hurting somebody, because I'm sure if I would have been driving, I would have hurt somebody. But so I go through this whole, you know, young adult age, and I'm just like running through people's lives, and I'm starting to do things with people that I don't really want to be doing, and I'm starting to be with people I don't really want to be, and I'm starting to, you know, have these consequences of my drinking, like not anything that's financial or anything like that, but more like emotional type stuff. Waking up in the morning going, oh my God, I can't believe I did that last night, or I can't believe I was with that person, or waking up with that person going, what the hell am I doing here? Why am I here? That kind of stuff. Or just doing things that were very hurtful to people, and waking up in the morning with guilt, shame, remorse of, I can't believe I did that last night. I can't believe I did that. I can't see that person. I can't talk to them now. I got to ignore them for a while. And I'm just waking up uncomfortable and starting that cycle of being uncomfortable in the morning even more. And my mind is thinking, well, I know how you can get some relief from that, man. A couple drinks and you'll be good. You'll be that place, that sense of ease and comfort. And I had no idea about this was going on at any level other than uncomfortable, get comfortable. You know, that's what it was all about for me. Around my mid-20s, I'm working for my family, and I'm really having a tough time showing up for work. And when I'm there, I'm useless. I'm just so consumed in self and pain, and like I'm doing a lot of behaviors that I wasn't really proud of then, and I'm hurting a lot of people in the process, and that's really following me to work, and I'm drinking and doing what I need to do in the morning, and it's not going away, and as a result, I'm not really able to listen to what my boss is saying, which is my dad, and I'm just completely incapable of that, and they saw that, and they were like, dude, something's up, you gotta do something after a few years of that. They suggested that I go get some emotional help. They weren't really stressing the drinking thing, but they were like, you need help. Something's up. Something's wrong. These people knew me all my life, so it was pretty easy for them to see what was going on. And so they're pretty much like, go or find another job. And I was like, okay, well, I like this job, so I'll go do whatever you want me to do. I was pretty desperate at this point. I was pretty suicidal. I didn't like my life. I mean, I never liked my life. But at this point, I always had this thing, alcohol, that allowed me to, like, be comfortable. Like, it allowed me to get up, and I'd look at the world, and I'd be like, yeah, this sucks. And then I would drink, and I'd be like, well, it doesn't suck that bad. You know, that's kind of what it did for me. You know, it changed the way I saw the world. And at this point, my mid-20s is not doing that anymore. It already had stopped kind of doing what I wanted to do, and I was not getting relief from it. So I showed up at work, and I was a mess, and they suggested I go there, and I'm hating my life. I'm hating you, and bless you. So I go to this family doctor, and they start asking me some psych evaluation questions, which I'm sure some of us here have heard, you know, questions like, you know, do you ever think about hurting yourself? And I thought it was a pretty normal thing that, you know, at some point most people think about hurting themselves, but the doctor had a different answer than that. And then she asked me another question, you know, which wasn't really unheard of for me, which was, you know, do you ever think about hurting other people? And the way I was looking at the world, the frustration and the anger and the hatred that I had for myself and you and the hopelessness, I was like, yeah, that wasn't abnormal for me to, like, think about hurting people throughout the day. And I told her that, thinking that most people, you know, had that going on once in a while, and she informed me that that's not normal for people to think about hurting people all the time. And so I found myself, through her suggestion, in the psych ward. But, you know, the crazy thing is, and, you know, she asked me about my drinking, of course, lied. You know, because that's not the problem. Don't take that away. That's the only thing that at some point was giving me relief. I can't give that up. But I knew something was up. So I go to the psych ward, and I get on these psych meds and all this stuff. And when I get into this process, they're like, you know, you probably shouldn't drink. Because like I said, I didn't tell them how much I drank. I just told me, yeah, I drink once in a while. I do some recreational type non-conference approved substances. And they're like, okay, you need to not do those things because if we're going to do therapy in this meds, you need to not do that because it doesn't really work well. If you're going to go through this, you need to be able to not do that stuff. And I, you know, and I didn't. And here's why, I think, because there was hope in what they were telling me. Like, I went to them because I knew something was wrong, and they were going, okay, we have a solution to what you're wrong. It's called psychiatry. And I was like, great. I'm like, okay, this is what's always been wrong. This has always been my problem. This thing that happened to me as a kid, you know, I have PTSD. You know, I have generalized anxiety disorder. I have chronic depression. I have, you know, bipolar. I have all these things. And I'm like, okay, that's what's always been wrong with me. Like, this is great. Okay, what do I need to do? You need to take these little pills. You need to come here for therapy. And I was like, okay, I'll do it. So I'm going there, and after about a month, I'm like taking this stuff called Prozac, and one of the side effects of Prozac is irritability. And I was beyond irritability after about a month of taking that stuff. I wasn't depressed. I was just pissed at everything. I'm telling you, I was just angry. Angrier than I had been before, and I went back to this guy, and you know, and I'm not trying to badmouth these people. They are absolutely trying to. They were just going by symptoms and signs and symptoms that I was giving them, you know, and I wasn't telling them the truth. And I told him that I had this anxiety and this irritation, and he was like, okay, well, here's what you do. Here's a prescription for Klonopin. Whenever you take, you know, whenever you get anxious, I want you to take these. And I was like, okay, and I did, and they worked really well. They work really well. If you have an anxiety problem, you know, Klonopin does the job. The issue with me is that I was kind of missing a big part of this problem, which is that I'm alcoholic. And I didn't know that then. One of the components of alcoholism that I know of today is why I'm alcoholic, is that when I start drinking, I can't stop. I didn't know that then. And one day I was eating these Klonopin like they were M&Ms. And I noticed on the side of the bottle it had one of those orange labels, and it said alcohol may intensify this effect. And I'm like, well, I thought to myself, well, if these work good now and alcohol is going to intensify this, then in theory they should work really good if I have one or two beers. Just a couple. I'm just going to have a couple. And that's all I thought, right? No idea about this phenomenon of craving. None of that information is going on in my head. All I'm thinking is, I'm just have a couple beers, man. This would be great. And then within a month, I'm like, screw the psychiatrist. I'm not going back. I'm right back to drinking. I'm right back to the bar. I'm right back to doing what I was doing. The drink had miraculously started doing what it used to do, and I was like right back to it. I was like, yeah, this is the way it used to be. And I'm like, right back to drinking, right back, you know, and within 2 months, I'm back to doing the same old thing I was doing. You know, I'm with people I don't want to be with, doing things I don't want to be doing in places I don't want to be at. And I'm hurting people, and I'm like, my dad had gotten sick, and he was in the hospital, and my brothers are like, okay, we need you to show up at the hospital because we're all going to visit dad, and we're going to be there at 6:30. Be there at 6:30. We're going to see him. Be there. I'm like, okay, I'll be there. And I would leave work, and I'd be like, okay, I'm going to go home. I'm going to get dressed. I'm going to be up there. But you know what? First, I'm going to stop and have a couple drinks at the bar. Just beer and a shot. I'll be good. And then I'll go home. Then I'll get changed. I'll jump in the shower. Then I'll be up there 6:45 at the latest, you know. And I would get there, and I'd start drinking. And I would, you know, 7 o'clock would come running around, and 7:15 after, and my phone would be ringing. And I knew who it was. I knew the number, and I saw who it was. And I wouldn't even answer because I knew what they were going to be saying. Where the hell are you? Where are you doing? Why aren't you here? You said you'd be here. You know, and that happened a lot of times. My brother got married. And it's pretty imperative that I be, that, you know, it's a pretty important day in your brother's life, you know, getting married. And, you know, they wanted me there. They invited me, and I told them I'd be there. And I decided that morning I was going to go out with a friend of mine and get a little buzzed before I went there. And you know, and my idea going into that was, okay, I'm just gonna go out. We're gonna have a couple beers, get a six pack, or hang out by the river, hang out, be done. I can be there by noon. Awesome. The wedding's at 1:00. I'll be there by noon. And 2:00, 3:00. I'm like, holy crap! I'm sitting in the bar. My phone's ringing. You know, that same old thing. That, and I'm like, didn't even answer it. You know. So a lot of those things were happening, and again, I didn't know what this thing alcoholism was. I didn't know anything about powerlessness, you know. So I'm same way at work. I'm capable of working, and I'm showing up at work, and they're my boss my parents, are like, okay, listen, you have a problem, and we need you to go get help for it. It's either do that or leave. And again, I liked work. I like working with my parents, and so I was like, okay, what do you need me to do? And they're like, you need to go to rehab. They're a little more specific on the drug and alcohol part, the alcohol part. It's AA, so I'll keep it to alcohol. They were a little more specific about that part, and so I went. And I went to this rehab, and they started talking to me about a kind of what I heard was a drinking problem. You know, the consequences of my drinking. You know, what it has done to me, and how much money I spent, and you know, they started talking about this. You know, what happened to me when I was a kid, and all this stuff, and what I heard got out of that, and it's not what they were saying, but what I got out of that was, okay, just don't drink, don't do these other things, don't drink most of all, and you'll be all right, and you'll be able to work through this stuff and have a productive life, and get, in my mind, that translates, productive life translates to, okay, I can get the car, get the job, get the house, get all the relationships I want, you know, I can have all the stuff that I wanted. That's what I heard. You know, productive life to me means I can get what I want. And so I came out of there with this attitude that, you know, I'm going to get what I want. I just need to not drink. Drinking is the problem. If I can just not drink, I'd be good. But today I realized I don't have a drinking problem. I realized that, you know, this is just my way of seeing it, is that if I have alcoholism, I don't have a drinking problem. That, you know, if I had a drinking problem, I could just not drink, and that doesn't seem to be feasible for me. I can stop drinking. I can stop drinking. I just can't stay stopped, you know. That seems to be my issue. I have this mind that keeps telling me, you can have one or two. You know, I have this mind that just keeps telling me to drink. Physically, if I could just not drink, I wouldn't. If my problem is that when I drink, I keep drinking, well, it'd be simple. Just don't drink. Except there's a second part to that. That I have this mental obsession, this mind that keeps thinking about drinking until I take one. So my problem is really in this whole thinking process, and I didn't know that. And I came out of there, and I went to AA, and I had this idea that I was just not going to drink. And this guy who I'd known a long time knocked on my door that day, and he did what a good AA member does. He came looking for me. He had heard that I got out of a treatment center. He literally came to my house, and one of those non-solicited 12-step calls. And he said, hey, I'm going to a meeting tonight. I'll pick you up at 6:30. And I was like, Bill, that's great. I need to go to these meetings, so that's awesome. How convenient for me. I'll be ready. And he came by and he picked me up, went to his meeting, first meeting outside of an institution. And we got there, and he introduced me to his little friends, who were all very much, much older than me. And I was like, okay, this will be interesting. And then he went over and he got this book off the shelf, and he opened it up, and he took out that blank page, and he took his pen, and he wrote a little inscription. It said, he actually wrote a little inscription, folded it, and handed it over to me, and I opened it, and it said, Jeff's first meeting, November 2001. Good luck. Love, Bill. And I read that, and I thought it was adorable, was my thought. I was like, wow, these guys really love me. Those rehab people weren't kidding when they said AA was going to love me till I could love myself. And I was like, they really love me. They're giving me presents. They're picking me up. How great is this for me? But I still had this idea that it was all about just not drinking. And unfortunately, that's not as feasible for me, or isn't feasible for me at all, actually. And I couldn't do that. So by 90 days, I'd picked up a drink. I had a thought in my head that was, dude, just a couple. Actually, a friend of mine, his mom had passed away, and we were at the funeral, and he came up to me out of the blue and was like, hey, he had two Michelobes, one in each hand. He said, here, want one? I said, sure. And I picked it up, and I drank. And I just like that. Didn't even think, wasn't even like, maybe I shouldn't. It was just like, okay, you know, just was like that. To this day, I can't understand that. But, you know, I know why now out of the book. You know, it talks about we have no mental defense against that first drink. So, you know, if we start thinking about a drink, for me, there's nothing that's going to stop me except, you know, the possibility of not thinking about a drink, which only comes through doing this work and a relationship with a power greater than me who's going to help me with that. But I didn't know that at this time, and I went back to drinking. And, you know, I'll speed it up. I was out drinking, and I'd come back to AA. Out drinking would get uncomfortable. I'd come back to AA, and AA would get uncomfortable. I'd go back to drinking. You know, I was flip-flopping back and forth, back and forth. My last run-out drinking was extremely, extremely painful. I was drinking, and I couldn't stop drinking, and I was not getting any relief from it at all. And I'm waking up hating the world with this uncomfortable, ugly view of the world, hating you, hating my life, hating everybody around me. And, And drinking's not touching it. I'm not getting any relief from it at all. And I got to this point where it talks about in the book where it says, you know, can't imagine our life with drinking. We can't imagine our life without drinking. It says something like, we'll be at the jumping off point. We'll know loneliness like few people do. And when I read that in the book, I was like, holy crap, that's where I was. Some of the most painful times in my life was when I was drinking and it wasn't working. You know, go figure. But I got desperate enough to come back here, and I called that guy, and I was so frustrated with my life in this world that it wasn't going the way I wanted. That I was so angry. You know, I was so angry. I just hated you, hated myself, but more so I hated you even more than I ever had in my life. And I hated the way this world looked. I hated everything about it. I just had this emptiness that was just indescribable. And I showed up at this guy's house. I called him. He was very sick at the time, but I realized this today that he got off, like literally off a sick bed, and came downstairs to talk to me. And we sat on his deck, and he lives up on this hill. It's beautiful and it overlooks this little town of Regalsville, and it's just beautiful. And we're out on his deck, and it was August 29th, 2007. It was a beautiful day, and I was in my grungy work clothes, and I'm here to tell you that I didn't see anything beautiful about that view. Nothing. If I could have bombed that town, I would have. But fortunately, I didn't have a bomb in my pocket, so we're all safe. So I told him what was going on in my head and what was going on, and he just sat there and listened. And then he kind of sat back in his chair, and he said, well, he said, I'm going to a meeting in a half an hour. I don't know what you're doing. I was like, oh, Jesus. Freaking AA. And here's my thought. I've been to AA. You ready? AA don't work. Tried it. Tried AA. No, I didn't realize that I'd just been in the fellowship of AA. I didn't actually apply the program of AA. I'd just been at the fellowship and hanging out with you guys. I didn't realize that for a guy like me, that's not sufficient. But I didn't know that. My idea was, tried it, been there, done that. I'll try it again, but I'm pretty sure it's not going to work. So I went there. 2 days later, I met this guy, became my sponsor. And again, I'm bringing up to where I was talking about before. I had met this guy. He was walking around. It was a meeting over in Sellersville. And he was walking around before the meeting, and very calm, cool, collected. People were talking to him. They seemed like a pretty likable guy. And they were talking about these spiritual principles and God. And I'm like, oh, man, what have I gotten myself into this time? And this guy takes the podium, not him, but another guy takes the podium and starts talking about this book and what happened to him when he did this, when he actually applied those things in his life. And I was like, whoa. I'm like, I just don't hear that from where I was going to AA. It's not common, let's just put it that way. And I was like, whoa, what is this about? And then, like, after the meeting, that buddy, my buddy who brought me there, he annoyed me into going to talk to this guy, which I did. And I went up and started talking to him. I said, hey, I was wondering if you could talk to me a little bit. And he said, sure. And I told him a little bit of what was going on in my head, you know, the hatred, the frustration, the anger, just the, and I was drinking. I can't stop drinking. And I just hate it. I'm back in AA. Damn it. I wasn't very grateful at that point. And what's funny is that, you know, he just kind of listened. And then what he did was something that was amazing. He told me about himself and how he had been prior to getting to AA and the way he saw the world. And it matched identically. I was like, holy crap, this guy knows. And it was obvious that he didn't feel that way now. I mean, this dude was like, you get that like vibe off of somebody, you know, when you come up next to him, you can just feel that energy. You know, somebody who's really like, and somebody who's just like, just smiling, and everything's good. And he's one of those guys. And I was like, oh, man, what do I need to do? He said, okay, you got a big book? I said, yeah, I got a big book. I've been in AA since 2001, dude. Come on. And he said, do you read it? The magical question. Not even do you do what it says to do in there. He was just asking me if I read it. And I was like, no, I didn't read it. And he said, okay, you're going to now, because if I'm going to be talking to you about these steps, we're going to be talking about them out of that book. We need to be reading the same damn book. So I want you to go home. I want you to read The Doctor's Opinion, read We Agnostics. I want you to call me tomorrow at 2 o'clock. And I said, whoa. So don't I need like 90 days or something to do these steps? And he said, Jeff, he said, you felt like crap all your life. I said, are you willing to wait 90 days to feel better? I said, no. He said, okay, then you're ready. He said, the book says there's a solution. He's like, he said you didn't read it, but I'm going to tell you in advance that there's a chapter in there called There's a Solution. The book is presenting you with a solution for your problem. He said, now, waiting 90 days to apply the solution will be similar to this. He said, if you go have a headache and you go to a doctor, he said, you have a problem, headache, solution, doctor. Go there, the doctor says, okay, I got this thing that will cure your headache. It's called aspirin. Here's what I want you to do. I want you to take these aspirin, go home, and wait 90 days to take them. He said, that wouldn't make much sense, right? I said, no. He said, okay, so AA is saying there's a solution. Why would you wait to apply the solution in your life? Why are you going to wait? I said, okay, I guess I'm not. He said, okay, go home, read that. So we get in the car, and he starts talking about the steps, getting ahead of myself. He started talking about the history that Saturday. And I get in the car, and he's talking about the history of AA. And he's talking about these groups prior to AA. I mean, I'm not talking like history, like Bill met Bob and Akron and the Mayflower, and they went to Akron and all that stuff, and the little gatehouse and Henrietta Cyberling, none of that stuff. It was all like, yeah, there was these groups prior to AA that stumbled upon this principle of one alcoholic sharing with another. These groups called the Washingtonians, a few other groups, and they had stumbled upon this principle of one alcoholic sharing with another, and they didn't know that that was part of the solution or that that was the one key element to this that would help us. And they didn't protect that, so therefore those groups went away. And he said then there was these other groups called Oxford groups who kind of stumbled upon the spiritual solution, but they didn't know how to apply it to alcoholism per se. So he told me about these other elements, and then he told me about these guys who stumbled upon all that and put it all together in a way that we can apply it in a simple fashion in our lives and recover from alcoholism. And but the biggest thing he was telling me about in history was this principle, one alcoholic sharing with another. And he told me, the principle is this, Jeff. He said, one alcoholic sharing with another alcoholic for the sole purpose of lowering your indifference to me so you can trust me enough to take some actions that you don't think are going to work. Now, when he approached me with these steps, I was like, dude, like, that's all great. I'm like, I don't think those steps are going to work for me. And he was pretty adamant. He said, Jeff, those steps don't care what you think. They don't care how you feel. They don't care whether you understand them or not. They're spiritual principles. They're actions. You take the actions, you get the results. He said, guarantee it. And I was like, oh. Then he, used that analogy of the gravity thing. You know, gravity's a principle. It doesn't matter whether you're having a good day or a bad day. If you fall off a roof, guess what? Gravity's doing what it's doing. And he said, these are principles the same way. So I got into this stuff, and what I realized today is that when he was talking about that one alcoholic sharing with another for the sole purpose of lowering your indifference, so I would trust you enough to do some things that I wasn't really prepared to do, is that's what he did in the kitchen. I trusted him. Just by relating his information to me about how he was, I trusted this guy enough to say, okay, I don't think they're going to work. Yeah, we don't care what you think. Okay, just do it. Okay, I'll do it. You know, and I'd run all my ideas through, and I was really pretty much completely out of ideas. Some of them came back. They always do. No matter how much we run them out, they seem to creep back in there. You know, ego doesn't take time, makes time to rebuild itself. But for the most part, most of my ideas are based in this love and service thing, whereas before they were based in what can I get from you. You know, that's the biggest change, is that, you know, my shift has become from what can I get from you? What do you think of me? What are you going to take from me? From what can I give you? What can I do for you? What can I, you know, how can I serve you? How can I love you most of all? Because I believe that's really where this is about. If I'm going to find any kind of connection with you guys, I have to learn how to love you. Now, I sat here from this side, years of therapy, thinking that, you know, in order for me to love you, I have to love me first. And I told my sponsor that, and he laughed. And he said, Jeff, that's exactly opposite of spiritual principles. He's like, spiritual principle is saying you need to love them first, and then they will love you back in their own accord. He said, you cannot acquire this thing called love. He said, the fact that you're going out trying to acquire love, he said, that sounds a lot like selfishness, doesn't it? Trying to get it for yourself. He's like, the fact is this, if you're going to trying to acquire love, he said, you're really being selfish. Selfishness is in opposition of the damn thing you're trying to find in the first place. He's like, no wonder you never found it. No wonder you could never get it. He's like, you were walking in the opposite damn direction. So he got me into this love and service thing. And I won't go through the steps other than, you know, say that I did them and I made some decisions early on. He kind of qualified me with the third decision of the job, you know, take the job with God. And I was desperate enough. I said, okay, yeah. You know, he qualified me with the problem, powerlessness, not alcohol. Alcohol is not my problem. My problem is that I'm powerless over alcohol. You know, our dilemma is this power. Powerlessness is basically my problem. Solution, power. How do I get that? I make a decision to seek out that power. You know, I was listening to a guy today, and he was talking about how it says in there, you know, God couldn't would if he were sought. And this guy started talking about when he was new, what he heard was, God couldn't would. And he sat there and he went, yep, God couldn't would. I'm good. God's going to do it. And he said he kind of missed that little part about the seeking. And he said basically the decision in three is to take the actions to actually seek God. Now, the paradox about this is that God isn't missing. Right? God's everywhere. And, you know, I made the decision in that step two. God is everything or God is nothing. What's your choice to be? It's simply a choice. And I was like, okay, well, without God, I'm going to die of this powerlessness thing. So, okay, God sounded pretty good. So I made the decision, God is everything. He says, so if God's everything, that means God's already within you. God's within all of us. You are part of God. We all are part of God. He said, so God's never been missing. You've never been apart from God. You just think you are. You believe you are. Your old ideas are, yep, somehow I'm separate. I'm over here by myself. And he said, that's not really the truth at all. And all the principles are saying is, let's get rid of all those things that are blocking you from the truth. And once those things are gone, you'll be able to connect effectively with the people around you. You'll be able to love them effectively, experience this thing called love, consequently experience this thing called God. That wholeness that Carl Jung talked about, you know, that ability to be part of. And he said, when you're able to be part of, you'll be able to be present. He said, you'll be able to experience the world at that moment, not be off in the future, back in the past. You'll be able to be present. And if you're present, you'll be able to be useful. And I never felt useful in my life, man. So I go through all this stuff, and I do this inventory, and I got awesome results from my inventory. If anybody ever tells you that an inventory is some scary thing, don't believe them. It's absolute freedom. If you do it the way it's in the book, you will experience freedom from that. There's absolutely nothing to be afraid of. And my sponsor kind of explained it to me in a way that looks that way. So I did it. I was like, okay, let's do it. Let's do this thing. And I did it, and I did a fifth with him. And he got me through 6 and 7. I sat and contemplated, and he got me right onto my amends. And one of those amends I'll just tell you about. I made amends to my brother. It probably would have been the hardest one to do. So I still had a relationship with my brother. It was never... my brother's a very naturally principled guy. You know, fortunately for me, he's a very principled guy. And I know he loved me regardless, no matter what I did to him. But I knew that bothered him and his wife, that I wasn't there. And it was going to be one of the hardest ones. So I went to him. And I basically said, listen, you know, I know I hurt you a bunch of times, but specifically by not showing up to your wedding. And it's not the kind of person I want to be. And if there's anything I can do to make that right, I'm willing to do it. So I believe that this is the path I need to walk, and I want to be close to you, and I want to be your brother, and I want to be a better brother to you. And so what is it that I need to do? And he just said, you know, he said, Jeff, just be there when I need you to be there, and just be a brother to me. You know, he's like, you've always been a pretty good brother. He said, you just kind of got diverted here and there. He said, just keep doing what you're doing and just be a good brother. And I try to do that. I call my sponsor after that. I said, dude, it was great. We're crying. Oh, it was great. And he said, okay, Jeff, it doesn't end there. Every time you go over to his house with him and his wife, he said, every time you go there, he said, bring something. My sponsor was all about showing up, bringing something. Bring something to the table. So, and I do that. I do that. I've been working with him all week, and every day I bring something. It's sometimes as stupid as a box of Tasty Cakes. Whatever, I bring something. I don't show up empty-handed. So I have these amends that I made, and one of them is this thing that I do for our community. I'm a big advocate about giving back, you know, and I give back in my family. I give back in here mostly. You know, I love AA. I love the connection I feel here, the way I feel part of here, and I love working with people. I love the sense of love that I feel here, but I also love giving back in my community. It's something that's been really important to me. I think sometimes it's kind of overlooked. We tend to focus on the AA and our families and at work, but I think sometimes we tend to miss out there people that we don't know, you know. And I had hurt a lot of people I didn't know, and so as a result, I got this amends where I volunteer for a local rescue squad, and I got my EMT, and I went back and I do that on a consistent basis. I show up and help people that I don't know, you know, when they need it most. As a result, I've become an EMT instructor, and I just work 2 days, Saturday and Sunday, as an EMT instructor, helping these young kids, teaching these young kids how to save lives, man. It's like just an extension of AA, you know, just teaching people how to help each other. It's amazing. It's remarkable to go from hating this world and hating the way you look and wanting to reached out and strangle half of you people to actually being able to say, okay, what can I do? How can I help you? You know, it's remarkable. I can't put that into words other than it's a that sense of love and belonging and part of that I've always sought all my life. You know, and somehow I had this idea that alcohol was the only route I could do that. I didn't know that there was another route I could do it. You know, and you know, I love Joe and Charlie to talk about, you know, alcohol being an artificial means to a spiritual experience. You know, we put it in ourselves and it changes the way we see the world. It's like literally alters our interaction with the world. And he said, you know, that's an artificial means to that. He said, but a practical means is these 12 steps. Applying this stuff, and Carl Jung said it, you know, ideas, emotions, attitudes that once were guiding forces in our lives, suddenly cast aside. Whole new set of ideas, emotions, and attitudes drive me today. I couldn't have done that on my own. I couldn't, not without you, not without this thing called God, not without a sponsor, not without doing this stuff. I just know. I tried for a long time. I tried by virtue to be good, and I just couldn't do it. I actually thank God today that I have this thing called alcoholism that brought me to my knees, that I came here and found this. I mean, there's a lot of people out there that struggle with the same mental frustration in their life who never find this because they don't have this thing called alcoholism. So how fortunate am I to actually be drug in the dirt long enough as a result of my alcoholism to come here and find this? Blows my mind sometimes. You know, I used to hear people say, I'm a grateful alcoholic. I'm like, yeah, who are you kidding? And now I find myself saying all the time how grateful I am that I'm an alcoholic, man. What a bonus, you know? Some of the most tragic things in my life are the very things that I used to help somebody today. And when that happens as a result of sponsorship and just working with other people, as a result, when I look at those things that are I thought were tragic, when I see them help somebody else, all of a sudden they cease to be tragic. It's like, again, that change, that mental perception that changes. The situation doesn't change, but the way I see it does. I experience love today on a daily basis. I'm not going to sit up here and say that I don't have problems. You know, I'm not always one that I want to do a 10-step. Sometimes I feel, you know, that little sense of adrenaline that comes from being self-righteous and indignant and being like, yeah, screw them. And then it gets really uncomfortable, and fortunately it gets uncomfortable. And sometimes God puts people in my life that happen to call me and be like, yo, dude, I need to do a 10-step. I'm like, okay, all right, I need to do one too, damn it. But the biggest thing is this working with others thing, which I don't have a lot of time, but I'll just kind of touch on that real quick. I've learned more. I've learned more by going through the steps with others, taking others, leading them to their path towards this power that's greater than them, to their relationship with the power greater than them, to their relationship with God. That strengthened my relationship with this thing called God. Like, I got a good sense of this relationship when I went through it with my sponsor, but I get a greater sense. It solidifies it even more when I take somebody else through it. It's like it becomes so much more concrete to me. It's like, it becomes so much less intangible and so much more real. There's no doubt in my mind that there's a loving, caring God that exists today. And it exists whether I think it exists or not. That's the crazy thing. You know? And I can't from this podium tell you how wonderful my days are, even when they're going bad, how much better my days are when I have that in my heart, you know. This content of your character, you know, this actions more so than the way I look. And I try to live my life with those actions today. I try to show up and love people. You know, my sponsor, I'll end with this. My grand sponsor, or my great-grand sponsor, is getting very close to the end. He's in hospice. I just got an email the other day. And I love this guy, man. It wasn't for him. This trickled down from him to me through a couple other guys, and it's like, it's just when I got that email, my heart kind of sunk, you know. But I know that he would want us to keep carrying on doing what we do. But he said something right in this room, right back by that post. There was a couple of us standing around, and he was talking about love. He loved to talk about love in 1 Corinthians 13, and he said one thing that blew my mind. He said, "I said, you know, I don't have to like you in order to love you." said, I can absolutely love you and not like you as a person, but I can still have love in my heart for you. And that blew my mind. Blew my mind. I still think of that today. When I get in the highway or whatever, I meet somebody, I'm like, I go, yeah, I can still love them. Doesn't mean I have to hold them by the hand and walk down, you know, walk jumping, skipping, you know, into the sunset. But I can love them. And the second that I do that, my heart, again, is like, oh, yeah, like I said, that peace again. That's what it's all about, that freedom. Freedom from that bondage itself, man. That's what it's all about. That's the goal. So I've talked long enough. I just want to thank you guys for listening to me. And come back again June 3rd. Barefoot Bill will be here. And I'll turn it back over to Christian. Thanks.